Hi, how's everybody doing this morning? Good. That means, you've gotten sleep while you're here. You're not out too late at night. There's not a lot to do here, I understand, in New Orleans. You're in the very long titled talk, Essential Truths Everyone Should Know About Performance in a Large Managed Code Base. My name is Dustin Campbell. I'm a senior program manager on the managed languages team, primarily focusing on the C Sharp and Visual Basic IDE and editing experiences. And I'm actually not the expert. This is a talk that was prepared by the expert, probably someone I respect very deeply on our team, named Paul Harrington. He's a performance architect on the managed languages team. And this is sort of kind of his crystallization of some of the performance measurements we've done, some of the kind of taking the projects we were working on the managed languages team and doing a case study around that and saying, how do we do performance at Microsoft? How do we measure performance? What tools do we use to look for bottlenecks in your source code? And then we're going to take a look at some of that, and then we're going to wrap up, which is going to be a long wrap up, of some very particular cases where we found bottlenecks in our source code and how we address those. So this is, again, for managed code. So if you're here for native code performance and optimization, that's not what we're going to be talking about here. And we're particularly interested in large managed code bases. Okay? We're going to talk about three truths. There are going to be three kind of essential truths that I want to share with you guys that I hope you can take away from here. They shouldn't be controversial at all. And like I said, we're going to see kind of some smells, some issues, and how we can fix those. Now, just to kind of level set in here, how many people in here have ever participated in a performance investigation? Okay, everyone almost in the room has. That's great. That's great. So you would be familiar then with this. This is kind of what we call the sad reality, which is, the user calls you or emails you and says it's still slow. It's just slow. Something is slow. I don't know what's wrong, but it doesn't feel right. Okay? And so you ask a bunch of questions. You ask, what kind of hardware are you running on? What is it you're actually trying to do? What's your workload look like? And then maybe you take a quick guess. Okay? Just kind of, you're an educated guy, want to take a guess and see what and at what the problem might be. And then you go back, maybe to the team, you start asking some questions, and some guru says, hey, try this. Maybe set some registry key. This might fix it. Okay? So you go back to the customer and say, hey, try this. They say, no. No, it's too slow. And so this goes on for a while, right? You kind of have a cycle here where you kind of go back, ask some more questions, make some more guesses, and then come back, ask them to to make some change on their end. And they say, well, it's too slow. And finally get to the point where you say, okay, just upgrade your hardware, okay? It's time to get the memory boost you've been looking for, get that SSD you've always been dreaming of. And no, it's still too slow. And so what eventually happens is that the user gets bored and they go away, right? And they find something else to do. Something else takes priority. And the real sad part about this is that nobody's satisfied at the end of this, right? I mean, you've engaged with the customer, but you didn't make any forward progress. And that's kind of unfortunate. And so I've engaged in this process myself, and it's no fun, and it's kind of awkward, right? And so at Microsoft, at least within developer division and on Visual Studio and the managed languages team in particular, we believe there's a better way. And so this is the process, the basic process that we go for. And that's first we assign key performance goals to user scenarios. So we define some user scenarios, and we define goals for those scenarios. That's the first step. Then we build tests to measure the performance of the product, the current behavior of the product. And the product might not even be finished yet. We're, on Visual Studio, we're, in the process of building the next version of the product, and we're testing the performance of a product that's in kind of in motion and in flight. Right? So we write automated tests. We want these tests to be automated so that, if it's not automated, if it's not run by a computer, if it's run by a human sitting in front of the machine with a stopwatch or something like that, then I'm far too easily influenced by my own wants and desires. And so these are automated so that we can run them again and again to kind of use for performance investigation, but also to track performance measurement over time. Right? We want to make sure that performance doesn't creep, like performance slowness doesn't creep in. Because over time, you can see the chart that says, well, no, it's just been getting worse and worse and worse and worse, and nobody's really noticed it day to day. But weeks and months later, you can see that the performance has definitely degraded. And so you want to be able to track that and measure that. And so once we're measuring performance, we know whether our goals are meeting or maybe not meeting. And if they're not meeting, we engage in performance investigations, right? And we make modifications to the product. We guide that by what we call the scientific method of performance. It's kind of this thing we make up for this talk, okay? And it is based on kind of the scientific method. Everybody learned this in high school, I assume? The idea that in the scientific method, when you're in a laboratory experiment, when you're in a laboratory experiment, you go in and you formulate a question. You ask a question. You then formulate a hypothesis and make a prediction that, you know, when you perform this experiment, you expect that this hypothesis will be proven in such and such way, right? Then you design, conduct an experiment based on that hypothesis to prove it. And then finally, you analyze the results, right? Did my hypothesis come true? Or do I need to reject it and perhaps come up with a new hypothesis? Now, the scientific method of performance is slightly different. It's mostly different because at the very beginning, we don't really know what's slow. We need to measure and figure that out. Okay, so we start off by measuring the current behavior. And the current behavior is, again, it might be an unfinished product, but we want to have some grounding, at least a baseline of data, to know what the current state of the world is, right? So first, measure the data. That gives us, besides giving us clues to the bottlenecks and where they might be, excuse me, that also helps us establish an environment that we're going to run our tests in. So that environment might include several kind of environmental constants, like, you know, hardware, or the OS they're going to run on, or the number of processors, or the number of cores, the workload, that sort of thing. We might have several sets of environmental constants. Maybe we have one for low-end hardware, where there's a single or a dual-proc machine, and then very, very high-end hardware. So we can measure across all of these different kinds of criteria in these various environments. And then, next, we're going to also use profiling tools to gather that baseline data. Who here is familiar with a profiler? Okay, it seems like everybody knows what a profiler is, so that's not going to be a problem in here. So the profilers are used to measure, to analyze the bottlenecks, okay? And so this is the point at which we've got all this data. A human needs to come in. A human expert comes in, analyzes the data, and says, you know, takes a look and sees where we're spending our time. And profilers are very good at seeing where we're spending our time. They're very good at looking at resources, for example, at CPU time or disk I/O, network I/O, memory allocations, right? And so we analyze these bottlenecks. We formulate a hypothesis about where the bottleneck is. You know, aha, I think the bottleneck is here, right? And then at this point, we're back on track with the original scientific method. So we make our hypothesis. We design an experiment. Where we can change the characteristics. Our control group in that experiment is the original baseline, right, the first measurement. We modify the code, we measure again, and that's our experimental group, our candidate. And then we can see, you know, do the diff between the results and see whether that removed or substantially improved the bottleneck. And hopefully, you know, we can either accept or reject the modification. A lot of times, in my experience, you will see a lot of rejections of modifications. And part of this is sometimes you're trying to understand how the system's interacting, right? And you learn more as you start doing these performance investigations, and not every change is a winner. But every change should, and very often, will lead to further investigation. It will give you information to help you form the next hypothesis. So making an informed kind of hypothesis instead of making a guess. And so make a series of these sorts of changes, and hopefully over time, you'll see performance improve. Now, this brings us really to our first essential truth, and that's that profiles don't lie. Profiles are not liars. You can speculate and hypothesize all you want. If you're not measuring, you're just guessing. Okay? This is really, 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 really important to point out. I want to make this very, very clear that, you know, if you're not looking at a profiler, you have no... You only have your best guess, and you don't have an empirical data. So many teams get, novice and expert teams alike, get kind of in this trap of just guessing without empirical data, and it becomes this vicious cycle. I mean, but if your bottleneck is CPU time, the profiler is going to point that right out. It's going to show you where it is, right? If it's disk I/O, the profiler is going to show you that Your CPU has plenty of CPU cycles laying around, but your disk is saturated. Okay? Essential truth number two is that good tools make all the difference. Okay? So when you're picking a profiler, you want to pick the best one you've got in your hand, available to you. There are a lot of great profilers out there. There's good ones built into Visual Studio. On the Managed Languages team and also across Visual Studio, our kind of our profiler of choice that we use is a tool called Perfue. How many people here have heard of Perfue? A few people. That's great. It's developed by Vance Morrison. There's others that have contributed to it, but Vance is kind of the primary guy that's been building that out. And it's available freely. You can Bing it if you like, or there's the download links up there. But he's a partner architect on the CLR. And so when it comes to writing a profiler for managed code, you couldn't really find a better guy to know how to get that done. Okay. So without further ado, though, I wanted to kind of take a look, and we'll just take a look at Perfue very quickly. This is not going to be a Perfue talk specifically. I just want to mention Perfue as a tool of choice that we use, kind of show you what we're doing. Okay. So this is Perfue. I apologize kind of for the small font here. But you can see Perfue. There's extensive documentation in Perfue. You're going to find hyperlinks everywhere in the UI that you can click on and find out more information about things. At the very end up here, there are videos that you can look at online that will give you more information. They're actually narrated by Vance himself, and so you can really learn how to use this tool. But I will tell you that it is definitely a dev engineered tool. Okay, it has not been cleaned up. It is not a Windows App Store app or anything like that. But it's built around event tracing for Windows, ETW, which is a technology that's been baked into Windows for a while now. It's baked into Windows from the kernel all the way up to user mode. And it's really the technology that at Microsoft, almost all of our profiling and performance tools are converging around, just because it's built in all the way from the bottom. So a lot of the Windows subsystems are instrumented with ETW. A lot of Visual Studio is instrumented ETW. It's something that you can use to instrument your own applications. It's not hard to do. So this is something that this is really a really great tool for both collecting ETW traces and also analyzing them. And so it's built around that, but also it's particularly good for managed code. So let's just do a quick collect. Now I'm going to do this collect, and it's machine-wide, okay? So it's going to elevate, but it restarts itself. And it's a machine-wide collection. I can run it in a different way so that it would collect for a specific process or whatever. But I like running it machine-wide. It tells me what everything's doing right across the system. And so there are some advanced options in here. I'm not going to set any of these. I just kind of want to show you that, what's available to you. Again, it's perhaps not the most inviting UI, but it is very, very capable. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and we're going to start a collection, and I'm going to pull up Visual Studio. Now, Visual Studio is a managed app. It's also a native app. I would venture to guess it is the largest, most complicated native managed mixed com interop app in development in the market right now. It's really kind of got lots of code running around, and it's particularly interesting for performance investigation. Okay, so close that down, stop the collection, and then Perfue is going ahead and it's collected the trace, it's analyzing the trace, and when it's finished, which didn't take too long, it's given us a really great report here with all sorts of information. So you can see here, there's just lots of information. I can click on, for example, we can look at some basic trace info. You can see the kind of the characteristics, the environment that we've run it in. This is a very, very hot laptop, so it's got 16 gigs of RAM and eight cores. So, but let's look at the CPU stacks, and this is going to show us again. It's machine wide, so we can look at we could drill into a specific process, or I'm going to right here. I'm going to click on all procs and just look at all processes, and this gives us the top stacks, CPU stacks, across these processes. So let's go ahead. We can click on, NTDLL. I don't actually have symbols for NTDLL on here, but you can see that you can see the threads that are calling into NTDLL. You can start going into this. Again, it's not really a Perfue demo. It's really to show you the richness in the information that you can get back from a really good profiling tool. Okay, we'll poke back at Perfue a little bit later when we start looking at some of the specific cases. All right. So Roslyn, this is actually kind of our case study bit. Who here has heard of Project Roslyn at Microsoft? Who is hoping for a Roslyn talk here? Oh, good, good. Roslyn is a project I've been working on for about 3 years. And if you don't know what Roslyn is, it is the rebuilding of the C# and Visual Basic compilers and language services, meaning the pieces of C# and Visual Basic that integrate into Visual Studio, in managed code, in C# and in Visual Basic. It's a very large solution. We have all managed code, about 80 projects, 2 million lines of code. And so we've got some performance needs. And I want to talk about a few of those things. First of all, it's not just a managed port. It's also a project where we're looking to expose the internals of the compiler, the internal memory data structures from the compiler as APIs so that tool writers and extension writers can use that information and we can use it ourselves. Introducing new code refactorings and code issue detection, that sort of thing. And then finally, there's also the C# interactive window, which a lot of people have seen because Anders Heilsberg has demoed it at Build in the past. So this is also a piece of this project. It's a very, very large project. So now, with regard to kind of our performance scenarios around Roslyn, we kind of break them up into two sets. So first, there's compiler throughput. And that's really just batch compile. It's just, you know, take a bunch of source files, put them in the compiler, compile it, see how long that takes to get an assembly to disk. And we can compare that then with the existing native compiler. The current C# and Visual Basic compilers are written in C++. And so that's our benchmark for compilation. And so we have very large projects that we attempt to compile. We can actually, with Roslyn today, we can compile the entire DevDiv source tree, at least for managed code. And so we have performance tests that test kind of the comparison with the existing native compilers and how that does. But more interesting from a performance aspect is the IDE responsiveness. This is somewhat more interesting because this is where the user really, really feels it if we get it wrong. Right? This is where if you're typing in the editor and there's that delay for, you know, just a half second before IntelliSense comes up, that's when you email me really angrily and you're very upset. And that's where we want to do a lot of our performance work. And so we kind of break these up into several kind of classes of features. There's the typing and responsiveness, the typing and IntelliSense features, right? So just basic keyboard echo, getting from the keyboard to the screen is there are a lot of features that come into play in the IDE that might get in the way of that happening, right? So there's, you know, like the completion list or signature help or brace completion formatting. All these things can happen while you're typing. And we want to make sure that we've tuned the performance of those so that the keyboard echo is still very good and still responsive. It feels snappy. And then you get into more kind of introspection features, right? Like navigation features, go to definition and find all references. And finally, get into kind of these kind of longer running, perhaps, features that kind of do solution-wide sorts of analyses, right? Like collecting of diagnostics to populate the error list, or the to-do comments to populate into the task list, that sort of thing. Now, these break down really interestingly. They break down into kind of responsiveness classes, right? So the first set of, you know, responsiveness kind of scenarios that we care about are those immediate responsiveness, where it's, you know, those kind of sub 100 or 50 millisecond delay times. And for that, I mean, it's really typing, right? We want typing to be in that sort of immediate responsiveness category. But then some of the features can take a little bit longer, right? And so they have a class of maybe that second or 1 second or 2 second sort of responsiveness. You know, say like the navigation features or something like smart tags or, you know, generate method stub. Those can take a little bit longer and they're acceptable. And then there's, of course, the cases that can take much longer, like diagnostics. Now, the performance characteristics of kind of these two, as we've broken these down, the actual compilation, is really just this pipeline, right? We bring in some source files and metadata. We parse. We build up syntax trees from that, in-memory data structures from that parse. Then we perform a bind, where we reason about the syntax trees. We reason about the in-memory data structures. And that's where a lot of diagnostics can get created. That's where things like overload resolution happen in the C# or VB language. And then finally, the emit stage, where we take kind of the results of the binding and we generate assemblies and metadata on disk. And then we let it all go. Okay, so you could think of it as like this pipeline where you just do a bunch of I/O bound work, you know, reading things in from the disk or, you know, from a network or somewhere. Then we do a bunch of CPU bound work. And then we do some I/O bound work at the end, and then we're done. Okay, so it's really just this very serial sort of chain, and that's how compilation has the performance characteristics of that. But IntelliSense again is much more interesting, where we're using the same in-memory data structures as compilation. We just use pieces of it. Right? So if I'm typing in a comment on a single line, we don't care about, you know, using the entire tree or realizing the entire syntax tree as we walk through it. Now, sometimes we will realize the entire tree, but, you know, in a lot of cases, we only need to use parts. Also, the data set that IntelliSense is drawing from is mostly unchanging. Right? It's kind of like you've got references. Hopefully your metadata references aren't changing all that often, and you can expect the data coming back from those to be the same. You know, you can imagine typing in a large class inside a large method, and you can imagine that all the rest of the source files, that data doesn't change. You can expect to be typing in one spot. So that's a performance characteristic. And then also we're doing speculative work on background threads, and we use async for this. And so we use async and tasks for this, but that ability to go out and figure out, detect code issues, find diagnostics, that sort of thing, gets done asynchronously. And so it often end up getting canceled. You know, if the user continues typing and we kind of need to go and reanalyze, then we're going to cancel those tasks. But for the most part, we try very hard not to block unsynchronous operations. So in the IntelliSense case, it's a good example where we actually are forced to block unsynchronous operations. With Roslyn IntelliSense, the computation for IntelliSense happens asynchronously. As soon as you type the first character that IntelliSense might come up on, we start figuring out what the data is to show. And if you keep typing, we're going to continue to process that, and it's okay. But as soon as we get to a place where you've typed a character where we'd have to actually commit IntelliSense and spit the right text into the buffer from the thing you picked, we need to block and wait for the data to finish collecting so that we can insert the right text. For example, is one place where we have to block. But in most cases, we work very hard on not blocking, and we're very intentional when we do. So some observations from looking at Roslyn. Really, we've been focusing very hard on the last 6 months, I would say, especially on IDE performance. We've always been looking at IDE performance, but then there was really a double down on efforts and kind of figure some things out. And one of the observations is that we are rarely directly CPU bound. Very, very rarely is that happening. You know, like I said, in the pipeline, the compilation pipeline, we're often I/O bound, right? We see that happen. But delays in the UI thread are mostly due to garbage collection. The garbage collector, you know, it spends a lot of time when you're performing a lot of allocations and throwing it at the garbage collector. Allocations can really slow down and affect your responsiveness. Okay, how many were in the async for library writers talk? Yeah, Alex talked about a bunch of this stuff, right? So when you're doing asynchronous work in the garbage collector, that can slow down your responsiveness. We're going to talk about some of that in here as well, as some of the things that we've discovered as we've been working on Roslyn. So allocations matter. And so you want to minimize allocations. We've been using for the last 6 months, we've been kind of going through this very rigorously, going through the scientific method of performance to figure out where the bottlenecks are in allocations. It's very easy to spot them with Purview. It just points them right out. It's like a, you know, big red thumb. But the things that have the most effect are when you can look at larger changes. I mean, you can make these kind of micro changes, and I'll show some of these micro changes that we've made that actually had very positive impact on performance. But the bigger changes are things like when you're able to reduce the size of an object that's allocated quite frequently, or you take a step back and look at various components and see that they could share data between them, that sort of thing. And you get the most performance benefit from that sort of change with regard to allocation. So that brings us to truth number three. I said there were three truths, right? Truth number three is that allocations are king. The time spent in the garbage collector, as I said, harms responsiveness. So there's kind of I have a mental model up here for how we tend to think of the delays the garbage collector incurs due to allocation. So if you think of the product of your allocation rate times the size of the heap, the size of the .NET managed heap, that's effectively kind of, you know, roughly might compute to some notion of what your average delay is. Because you can think of the allocation rate as affecting the number of garbage collections you're going to get. So if you're allocating lots of memory, you'll incur more GCs. And then in addition, if your heap size is very, very large, then the cost of actually performing a GC is going to be much larger. It's going to be longer to run that mark and sweep algorithm that the garbage collector runs. Okay? And so the corollary, of course, is just allocate less. And so let's see how we can do that. All right? Now, as we look at this, I want to be very clear. This is not a blacklist on language features. Okay? We're going to look at things that, as we've been investigating performance, as we performed that measurement, looked at the allocation traces, found some bottlenecks, often these were kind of smells that guided us to some kind of hidden allocations that were bothering us, right? If they're not bothering you, they are not a problem, okay? Don't just start going through your code and removing everything and reverting back to C# 1.0 or anything like that, okay? That's not useful for your team, it's not useful for you. These are very good features. But these are things that come up, right? So boxing. Who knows what boxing is in here? Good, okay. Strings and string manipulation, iterators, delegates and lambdas, link. Should probably put async on here as well, although that's very, very efficient. We have run into some cases around async, some of which were fixed by introducing async, okay? All right. So first up, we're going to look at boxing. Now, boxing, everybody said in here, it looked like there were a lot of hands in here, said that boxing they understood what that is, and that's when you take a value type and you convert it to an object so you can treat it like an object, and it becomes heap allocated instead of perhaps allocated on the stack. So these are very, very easily found in Perfview. You can look at the specific the GC heap Alex view, and you can just look for things for allocations on the GC heap of value types, right? If you see int32 on there, well, that's a big problem, right? Because int32s are 4 bytes when they're values, but the smallest object you can have on in the CLR is 12 bytes, right? So that's somewhat inefficient. That's 3 times bigger than it needs to be. Boolean's ridiculous, right? You're talking about a bit, and you're representing it as 12 bytes. It seems somehow a little bit inefficient, right? So let's look at our first example. And I actually have this ready to show you. I have a trace for this that I can show you in Perfview, which is kind of absorb the example right now. I mean, it's this logging function. We're passing in some ID and a size, and we log out a string format. And it's fairly simple code. You see this sort of thing all the time. Okay. Let's flip over and take a look. Now here I have this all already built up. So this is a trace I already have. Again, I said that Perfview is really great for collecting traces, but it's also really great for analyzing traces you already have on disk. So this is a very useful tool. So we'll bring up the GC heap Alex stacks, and here is a project I built that has some of our examples in here. So I'm going to drill into that process in particular. And you can look right here. You see, yes, indeed, int32 appears on the GC heap. Okay. Now, what's worse is about 73 megabytes of allocation. So that's probably a little more than it needs to be. Again, 12 bytes per int32 instead of 4, right? You could easily reduce this. So I'm going to double-click on that. It's going to take me to the system.int32. It's going to show me 2 places where this is actually allocated from. And so we can expand this stack. And we can see, in fact, it's right in the log function that is on the slide. Okay. There's also another one over here, and we're going to look at that a little bit later. Another allocation where int32s get boxed in this application. Okay, let's flip back over. So, who can point out the boxing to me in this particular example? Yes, sir. String format takes an object param, so passing in the ints they get boxed object. That's correct. Actually, it's not the one that takes object params. There's one that takes 2 object. So because ints are convertible, obviously, to object, and so boxing is introduced, and you pass these into the string format call. So so these guys get boxed. The fix is to do something like this. Right? It still allocates, but you're allocating the same strings that would have been allocated inside the string format anyways, right? So when they called toString internally. So it's the same thing, but you avoid the boxing. Now, this wouldn't obviously work if you were using format specifiers to format them as hex and that sort of thing. And you might have some enterprising developer on your team that comes and says, well, what we're doing here is actually string concatenation, right? We should just do this. That makes much more sense. But that's a different problem. So This actually compiles to string.concat with object. Okay? Who can tell me why? Any thoughts? It's right here, because we put a char in there. And a char is a value type. And so that boxes. And so now the overload resolution picks the one that takes object. Okay? So the fix, wait for it, watch very carefully. And these are very subtle, right? But the profiler points these right out to you, okay? And that's where we've been able to, and I'll show you some examples where we've been able to really find some of these bottlenecks, and just some of these little micro changes actually can have a meaningful impact on performance. Here's one that's real and was found in Roslyn, and it was very frustrating. And unfortunately, it's one you just kind of have to know. You wouldn't ever look at the code and see it like you were able to see the boxing to string format. But there's boxing in here. It's right there. And again, it's something you'd have to know. It's unfortunately just kind of the way the .NET framework works. But when you call get hash code on enum, the implementation boxes, unfortunately. And so that's just a bad thing. You know, trademark, bad thing. But the fix here, and again, this is not something you should worry about too much, right? But if your profiler points it out, this is a case that we ran into that was an amazing number of bytes allocated. And so the fix is to cast to int first, right? Of course, if the enum is, if the underlying type of the enum is a byte or a short or a long, you'd cast appropriately. But that's the fix. And this was a case where the enum was being used as a key in a dictionary, right? And that was accessed all of the time, and so get hash code was called multiple times. And so we created a custom comparer to perform the cast for us. Okay. Moving away from boxing into string manipulation, because string manipulation is a problem sometimes. Because our programs have lots of strings. Roslyn certainly has lots of strings. It's about parsing source code, right? And so it certainly has lots of strings, but every application has lots of strings. I mean, we've fallen in love with XML. We've fallen out of love with XML. All of our protocols, REST and everything are all string-based protocols where you pass data around as strings. Even though strings are pretty inefficient data structures to be passing around binary data, but that is the world we live in, right? And so a lot of our applications deal with string manipulation. So very often, string is at the very, very top. When you look in a profile like Perfew, string will be at the very, very top. And even string builder allocations can be a bottleneck, right? Because you're going to follow that up with a two-string call, so that's going to be an allocation. String builder itself internally is going to have arrays of chars that it's allocating to do its work. And so so there are a couple of things you can do here. I mean, we look at things like concat, substring, join, split, those sorts of things for string manipulation. But on string builder, it's something where you consider pooling. Okay, so let's take a look at a couple of examples. So this is from the Roslyn code base. It's doing some printing out some formatted XML.comment. So it's looking for the // and that sort of thing, and printing out printing some XML.comment. And it's unfortunately loaded with allocations. It's kind of ridiculous, actually. So there's the first one that's sticking right out to you, right? We're creating a string array right here every time you call the method. It's a compile time constant, really. We should certainly be pushing that out to a static field somewhere. But then we call string.split to split this into an array of lines. Okay. Next, we're going to walk through and do a trim start. Now, the idea here is we just want to trim the white space off of each of these lines. But we do it three times. Okay? And then here's the horror story about trim start. It's not really a horror story. But when you're concerned about when you're really looking for allocations and reducing allocations, this is how trim start is actually implemented. It's passed a params of chars. So the compiler, when you call it with no arguments, is creating a new array of zero elements of char for each one of those. And then, of course, down here, there's a substring. And what's really problematic about this is that, I mean, this is the sort of code you can write, but it's really, you've got this text that comes in, and all you're doing is looking at some offsets and performing substring manipulation. And when you think about what substring really is, it's just a start and an end, right? And so when we address this problem, we could address them one at a time and try and kind of, micro-optimize this, but this really needed a rewrite. And in terms of starts and end offsets into the original text that's passed in, right? And so this is what it looked like. This is kind of a flavor of what it looked like. So, you know, writing a function to find the index of the first non-white space character, for example, is the first function, right? And it doesn't allocate at all. You know, getting the finding out if the trimmed string would start with some prefix, again, doesn't allocate at all. So we were able to make this essentially allocation-free without a lot of effort. But it did require, well, I should say without a lot of effort, it did require a rewrite. String builder pooling. So this is just an example, again, from the Roslyn code base, of someplace where we're using a string builder. And the idea was building up type names, right? And so we're going to append on, you know, the angle brackets and the T's and the commas and all of that. But this allocation really kind of matters, right? So you allocate the string builder. If this is called lots of times, if get full type name is called multiple times, many times in the application, then this is going to be an allocation bottleneck. And so in these kinds of cases, the almost always the best thing to do is to consider pooling, right? And even a pool of one is still good enough. And so something like this, right, where we cache the string builder, and we acquire it, and then we release it at the end. Notice the important bit up there is the thread static. So if multiple threads are calling into this this get full type name function, we want to make sure that they're getting their own instance of the string builder, and we're not dealing with different instances in thread crossing situations. So it ends up looking like more like this, where your code is in the middle, and where it had, you know, you newed up the string builder before, and you got the two string at the end, looks kind of like this. So this was also a big performance win. Okay. This may turn into somewhat of a rant. Now, I love enumerables, links, and lambdas. I absolutely love them. I did, you know, blog articles on functional programming and C#. I've done all that sort of thing. And I can just imagine the developer, that just something about this stuff really makes you feel good. And you can just imagine the developer writing this code, getting it to a single line, right? A single elegant line and saying, I have arrived. I'm a true engineer now, right? And it is beautiful, and it's very pretty. And it's not something I want to discourage you from writing if that's the thing that makes sense for you, okay? But I want you to appreciate the allocations behind the scenes because it's loaded with allocations. And if it is something that gets called frequently, if it turns out to be a bottleneck, then this code is definitely a little bit smelly. So first off, the lambda. So lambda, you know, is going to be passed as a delegate. So I'm just going to kind of pull this out. We're going to kind of move this code around a little bit and show you some of the allocations under the hood. There's also a hidden new here, but I'm not going to get into that yet, a new of the delegate. Because the important thing is this capture. We're actually capturing the parameter name that comes in. And this can turn into, and whenever I see these captures in high-performance code, I get a little concerned. Alarm bells start going off because the machinery that needs to be generated by the compiler and the allocations that happen under the hood to support this are not exactly the cheapest things in the world if you're thinking about high performance. So, for example, this is going to result in the allocation of a non-static helper class, okay, a closure class, if you've heard that term, to capture the variable into to lift it to the heap, so that it can be used across calling this delegate many times, and that its value can continue to be updated across multiple evaluations. So it looks something like this. I'm taking some liberties here. Right, so there's a class with a field for that variable name. That's where the function now lives, the actual lambda expression body lives. We knew that up, and then we also knew up the delegate down at the very bottom with the evaluate method. So there's allocations there, but that's not all. It's not all. There's some subtler ones. So first or default was called, right? That's an extension method, and it's an extension method on IEnumerable. Okay, and so that kind of unrolls, again, taking some liberties, kind of unrolls something like this, where symbols is cast to IEnumerable, and we get the enumerator, we loop through, and if for the first one the predicate returns true, we then return the value, the current value from the enumerator. The important thing is that there's a loss of type information here. And this, again, this is subtle. Notice right there in the green box, it says that list of t's enumerator is actually a value type. Okay, list of t has a nested struct called enumerator that is returned when you call getEnumerator. It doesn't actually. It has a public method called getEnumerator that returns that instead of an IEnumerator. And so what ends up happening is that this boxes the list of T's enumerator because it's casting it to an interface. Okay, so that carefully constructed enumerator gets boxed. You're probably asking yourselves, why is it, why is it actually a struct? We'll get into that. But here's what the code should look like if you want to essentially be as clean as possible with regard to allocations. This is actually allocation free. And so back on that enumerator thing, well, how can this be allocation free? I mean, this is a for each, right? I thought for each worked on IEnumerable. Actually, in the C# language as it's defined, for each is a pattern-based construct, similar to how link works, where that's pattern-based over select and where methods and those sorts of things. For each, if your type has a getEnumerator method, it will prefer to use that instead of casting to IEnumerable. So list of T has a getEnumerator that returns that struct, so there is no heap allocation when you enumerate over a list of T. So that's a cost savings in allocations. And so this is allocation-free. It's awesome, right? And what I want to point out about this is that, yes, I mean, sometimes when you rewrite some code to take advantage of some performance optimization, it can look really ugly, right? You can wind up in this code that's all commented every place. Oh, we're doing this here for perf, we're doing this here for perf, and that sort of thing. And in this case, this code is perfectly readable, perfectly sane, very, very pretty, right? I think it's just fine. Just for each through the symbols, check to see if the name equals the one that's passed in, and return it if it does, okay? All right. And so, yes, this is what the rewrite would look like. As I said, getEnumerator just returns list of T's enumerator as a struct. All right, an async example. Now, if you were in Alex's talk, at the very end, he started to get into this, and it went really, really fast. But it's this idea that when you're doing async and you want to cache values, when you do async, you will there are allocation overhead that gets incurred due to the construction of the task objects that can get returned. Okay, so there's some allocation here just even on parser.syntax where it's going to return that, but because this is an async method that returns a task of syntax tree, it's going to wrap that in a task, right? And so one of the devs on our team thought, well, I should cache this. That makes tons of sense, right? That's going to, help the user quite a bit, right? It's going to definitely improve performance. This is something that's very expensive, parsing the source code, parsing the syntax tree. That's the expensive piece, so let's go ahead and cache the result. So the next time we call, we'll just give back that result, right? But now you have an allocation problem, okay? Because right here, the compiler's going to rewrite that to task of syntax tree dot from result, passing in that result. So you're actually not caching the right thing. And so this is what Alex talked about. Instead of caching values, you want to cache the task itself. Okay, so you can think of it as I spin up a task and I'm saying, okay, spin up this task and it's going to start running. I'm just going to hand it back. But I'm going to remember that task. And so anybody else that calls me, I'm just going to keep giving back that task. And they're going to wait on it, right? And eventually, it's going to complete, and everybody's going to get told about it, and everybody's going to get the same value. Later on, when it's actually completed, and you've still got a hold of it, and somebody asks again for it, you just give back the same task, and it gives back the results already cached within the task, right? So ends up looking something like this, right, where we've now taken our async method, where there's an async keyword on it, we've made that private, and we call this, syntax tree uncached async, get syntax tree uncached async. And that's where we do the exact same work we did before. But then we have this cached result field where we cache the task. And so that gets called with get syntax tree async. We use that, and if it's null, then we're going to assign it to the result of calling get syntax tree uncached and return that. That line of code at the end is definitely somewhat obfuscated C#, but it fits on screen really well. All right. So let's talk a little bit about class versus structs. Because there are problems, especially with regard to structs. And I just want to make sure you understand kind of the differences between these guys as they relate to performance. So classes, obviously, reference types, they're allocated on the heap, and they're cheap to pass and return, okay? Because they're just pointers, right? The smallest object, again, as I said, on x86 is 12 bytes. That's different on x64. But then in contrast, structs, when they're allocated locally, they're allocated on the stack, right? Unless they're boxed, and in that case, they get elevated, they get lifted to the heap. And then large structs are actually expensive to copy. So if you get structs that have lots and lots of fields in them, they can be expensive to copy because the CLR, the jitter will generate machine code that guarantees that the copy is atomic and we don't want to have any tearing in the value type when it's copied. And so those can also result in a CPU bottleneck if you use very, very large structs. And something in particular to watch out with structs are property getters, right? Because these can incur that copy cost if the struct is big. So you can wind up in a situation where you're accessing a property a lot of times, and then that's causing copies to happen back to the stack. But if the structs are large, then that copy is not cheap. Okay, so if you access a property a lot of times, then of course the fix is just to assign it to a local variable, do the copy once. But something to watch out for, again, something that Perfew will point right out. So let's look at an example of structs versus classes. Now, assume this is called a lot. This is a kind of a logging function where you use an idisposable pattern. You have a using blocking. Say, okay, I want to mark the beginning and end of this. And it's a very common thing to do, right, where you log out some begin and some entering, entering function, leaving function. The problem here is that it's called a lot. And so you want to reduce the cost of this because to use the using construct, that using statement, you need a new up, cons up, allocate a new heap object, right, in order to do that. And so the fix right here would be make it a struct, right? That's a different problem because now it's boxed, right, because we're returning idisposable. And so the real fix here is not just to convert it to a struct and allow it to be idisposable, but then again, to go ahead and actually make it public, make the struct public, and return that type instead of idisposable. Okay, so the compiler is smart enough to look at the, once you're in the local method body, to generate IL that takes the address of that struct and call the virtual function through the interface. Right, but it doesn't incur boxing because it's smart enough to take the address once it's on the stack and can do that. But if it were passed across this method boundary, you're kind of out of luck. Okay, you can also get into some cases where you can fix some of these cases by making them structs and passing them by reference around. Kind of thinking about it in the way you might have done it in C, where you're passing something by reference, you're making it const, but we don't have const, so you have to apply some discipline so that you don't actually update the struct. So you can get into some problems with that, but it is some way to reduce some allocation. Okay, it's another rant. Dictionary. This is a smell only because it gets used everywhere. I see it dictionary happy developers all the time, and it's often inappropriate. You'll find dictionaries that are just used because they want to have that constant insert, they want to have that constant lookup time, but they might not actually need it, right? Because dictionaries are very, very good as when they're filled with data, when they're large collections of data, and now you get the performance benefits of having a dictionary and having that constant lookup time. But often, you'll see them in applications, and you start looking around at a large code base, you'll see dictionaries start popping up that are many times just empty or have one item, right? Something that an array would be completely suitable for. And so they become very, very problematic. It's this problem of having where you, in the framework, you have these general purpose collections, and we don't know how you're going to use them, right? So that we make them as general as we can. There's an effort to make sure that they have some reasonable performance characteristics in common scenarios. But you can get into these cases where, you're just overusing it, right? So, as I said, it's not efficient for small collections. The empty dictionary has 10 fields. And then prior to .NET 4.5, it had 11 fields. So it was, prior to .NET 4.5, I think it was 52 bytes to just have an empty dictionary. And now it's 48, so a little bit of savings there. But and as I said, most of them are single-digit element counts. And then the hybrid dictionary is not much better. And for small collections, you could just have an array of list of key value, right, pair. And that would be much better, right? So the other thing about dictionaries is that they're often, when they're used, people often don't continue to insert and remove items. Once you build up this collection, you have this process where you're like, I'm going to calculate all this stuff, I'm going to stuff it in a dictionary, and I'm just going to use it to look up into, right? And there are other ways to do that. So there, but they are often read-only once populated. And the sad part is that there aren't any great alternatives. Okay, and so we end up kind of rolling our own sometimes, so that we have some map data structures that are kind of custom to ours. I would recommend taking a look at Frugal Map. Bring up Reflector. This is one case I'll tell you. Look at Reflector. Look at ILSpy. And look at the code of what they did in Frugal Map. Frugal Map's a really interesting study because in the case where there are no elements in the dictionary in their map, it's null, right? There are it incurs essentially no overhead, right? If there's one element, you get back a map of one element, right? And then I think as it grows, you start getting back different maps of three and six elements until finally, at the very end, when it gets much bigger, they actually just make it an array. It's not even a sorted array, but it's still more efficient because in a lot of cases, because they've covered kind of those very, very common, you know, small element number cases. Okay. Oh, here's what I wanted to look out for. So this is the sort of thing that you find and you get a little frustrated by. In the framework, this is how read byte is implemented. So read byte, you would expect that read byte just reads a byte and returns it. It doesn't. Indirectly it defers to the read function, which requires it to allocate an array of one byte, and then returns the first element of that. And so this is the sort of thing that is kind of frustrating. Read to end also uses temporary char buffers to fill out like a string builder kind of thing. There's a whole bunch of places where you can incur allocations simply in the framework. And of course they made this virtual so you can override it and fix it if you like, right? Thank you, that's great. And a lot of the actual implementations of these like memory stream and things do a better job with this. This is just their base implementation. But it's something to be aware of if you're using a stream implementation and you haven't overridden this function, if you have your own custom stream implementation, then you can wind up with allocations that were completely invisible. Again, Perfew will point them out, or any good profiling tool should point these out. Caches. This is kind of a pithy expression. Been around. I'm not the one that said this, right? But it's a cache without a discard policy is a memory leak, right? And so when you are working on your code and you're building out caches and you're thinking, well, I need to cache this data. I'm calculating this way too many times. I'm calculating it over and over again in different scenarios. I'm calling the same functions. I should cache this. And then what happens often is you don't think about, well, how large is this cache allowed to grow? Is it a time-based thing? Is it a size-based thing? But when am I supposed to be removing items from this collection because of this map? Because if you don't, it's just a memory leak, right? It's fast, and it's kind of a traditional space versus time sort of trade-off. So it's very, very quick, but it's a memory leak. So when you're building a cache, always be thinking about what is going to be your discard policy? How are you going to when are you going to start removing items? What is the policy on this cache for when that happens? All right, this is actually my last slide because I want to have some time for questions if folks have them. So thread pool starvation. This is something we've run into an awful lot in Roslyn. It's the idea that the thread pool manager adds threads very slowly. Right, it's actually very well tuned for ASP.NET and server and desktop applications, and it uses this hill climbing algorithm for determining when and how it's going to add threads. But it does it in a very slow manner. Right, it starts out with a certain number, and then if you put too much work on that thread pool, it's generally about once a second it's going to create a new thread, and so you can wind up in a place where if you're just spinning off a bunch of tasks and you're not really actually calling a wait to return those threads back to the originator, you can wind up starving the thread pool and winding up with some really bad performance. Okay, so this is something that we've run into a lot. Again, if you didn't go to Alex's talk in the last session, which was the async for library writers, where he talks about some of these issues about writing fast code with async, he talks a great deal about this and at length. And but the fix here is, if it's appropriate, if you can do it, is to await that. Right, is to await the tasks so that the threads get released, right, and they can come back and be used for other work. And then when you return to them, when they return to you, rather, you can continue there instead of blocking those threads. This happens a lot. Like in Roslyn, we'll find it with colorization is a good example, where you're typing code and we're constantly trying to colorize, and so we're firing off tasks to colorize these things, and we can't. And but the editor in Visual Studio is somewhat synchronous. It expects you to give back the data, right? Or give us an event and then give us back all the data. And so we start allocating these tasks, but we allocate them very, very quickly in these performance tests. You type for a minute, right, nonstop, and we're constantly building up colorization data. And so we've had to do a bunch of work to ensure that we don't start incurring threads to be created, right, and end up with a situation where the thread pool is now starved, and now the UI is unresponsive because it's just trying to colorize the code that should be very, very quick. All right, so in review, again, I wanted to leave some time for questions. These are some kind of the basic truths we talked about, right? Profiles don't lie. You need to measure, and you need to use a profiler and collect good empirical data. If you aren't, you're just guessing, like that original sad reality where you just guess and come back with a user and it doesn't actually work, right? You need to look at a profiler to understand where the issues really lie. And then you need a good profiler. I recommend Perfview, though I know there are other good tools. Obviously, Visual Studio has good tools. In particular, Perfview works very well for us because the application is so large, right? And the profiling tools in Visual Studio tend to work up to a certain kind of level. They scale to a certain level, but when you get really big, Perfview is a very good tool for that. It scales very well. And then finally, allocations are king. This is a place in .NET applications where most of the performance issues lie. And I want to be really clear here. The garbage collector is not slow, right? The garbage collector is amazingly efficient. But if we're not careful, and we're in these kind of high performance situations, and these tight inner loops, allocating like mad, the garbage collector can kind of work against us and hurt our performance, right? So often you'll find performance fixes are about reducing allocations. All right, and so that's what I've got for you. So let's take some time for questions. There are microphones, or if anybody wants to just come up here, if you want to take the time, that's fine. But I want to hear. If you guys have any questions about this sort of thing. All right. Yeah. Could you get the mics on, please? There.
How much of the tuning is going to go away in the next version of the .NET?
I'm sorry, how much of what?
How much of the tuning is going to get away in the next version of the .NET?
How much of the tuning is going to get into the next
version? How much are you implementation dependent of the compiler?
Oh, of the ROS compilers, how much are we implementation dependent of the next version of .NET? Right now, the compiler still targets 4.5. And so that's where we're at right now. Is that there's a difference between though what framework you're targeting and what and what the compiler actually has to run on, and then what it actually has to generate code for. It can still generate code for earlier .NET framework versions because that's what the application can do. But it's what framework it runs on might be a different story. And so that's probably going to be tied to what version of Visual Studio it might ship with, and what framework is there in that case. Does that make sense? Yes, Perfview is a free tool. Perfview is available. I downloaded it. It was like a zip file and like a single exe. It's sort of like getting something from sysinternals where it just magically unpacks itself and does, yeah. Yeah.
So do you make this performance monitoring and evaluation part of your regular development schedule, or is it something that you do at the end? Or it seems like, how do you make it a priority for your project to management?
So performance is a priority through the entire development cycle. Before we start even coding features up, we've defined what their goals are, what their scenarios are, and we've got somebody looking at building performance tests that might, what we would want to build there. Sometimes you can't build it until the feature's at least partially there, right? You can't actually, but you can, but in a lot of cases you can. You can just use current infrastructure. So no, we do it from the beginning to the end. Yeah.
One more follow-up question. Do you have any recommendations for tools for web-based development?
For web-based development? If you have access to your server, Perfview is still a great thing to get traces, right? And so to actually for a profiling tool, I'd still recommend Perfue. It depends on what you're trying to do with that, but we do have, you know, tests. We do have infrastructure for doing, you know, web load testing and those sorts of things for those specific scenarios. Very often, you'll find that Perfue is still going to point out, be the tool that can help point out the bottlenecks. If you're doing web load testing, if you can hook up and, you know, grab an ETW trace, then you can analyze that with Perfue. Okay.
How do we define your goal?
How do we define our goal? Usually, it's pretty simple. Often it's related to one of the responsiveness classes, right? As defined, you know, the Windows defined all these responsiveness classes. We kind of latched onto those. So, like I said earlier, you know, typing is kind of in that sub 150 millisecond responsiveness class. We call the immediate class, for example. That's a goal we set. In our particular case, now in this particular case study, we do have a previous implementation to compare against as well. And so we have some goals set against that. A good example of a goal we set in batch compile. Because, you know, we're building a managed compiler. It's definitely got more overhead than pure, raw, native C++ that it was originally written in, right? And we expect it to be slower. And so we set a goal of no more than 2 times slower than, this is our original goal, of the native compiler. And we actually adjusted that goal as we went. We started kind of, you know, in this with this goal of, you know, under promise, over deliver. What ended up happening was we were able to make more significant gains. We also got feedback that maybe that goal wasn't aggressive enough. We got more significant gains. And then finally, we defined new environments on which we were going to test that goal. Right, and so now it became no more than, I think for a while it was no more than 2 times on a single proc, right? And then because we are building a system that is, I didn't really get into much of how the system is put together, but it's a bunch of immutable data structures in the compilers and in the IDEs. It uses an immutable snapshot model, and that allows us to do things in parallel that we've never been able to do before in the compiler. And so we're able to set different goals for different environments. So on multi-core machines. I believe it's running faster than the native compiler today. Yeah?
My question is related to Visual Studio. Why is Xamarin Editor so slow?
Your question is related to Visual Studio. Why is the XAML Editor so slow? Oh. You mean the XAML Editor or the XAML Designer?
No, editor.
Oh, the Editor.
Every time you move to Visual, it is not responding.
There are some things in the XAML Editor. Okay, the XAML Editor guys work really hard on performance, but they have a very big problem to solve. And some of their performance characteristics that I'm aware of, and I'm not the expert on the XAML Editor, okay? I'm just going to say, I know they have some performance characteristics that are very hard to kind of overcome in the current system. For example, you know, they have a dependency property design, right, where they have to look at all of the types in the .NET world and see if they might have dependency properties that applies to this guy. And that's an expensive operation, for example. And they do a lot of work to do this with, I know that for a while there, and I'm not sure if they're still doing it this way, but for a long time they did it with .NET Reflection. And so they'd load up a new app domain and figure out everything. So, and they've been working on this and trying to tune it and get it better and better. They actually put it out of proc in the last release, a lot of that work. So, It's slow, I think, in part because today in Visual Studio they don't have a project like RASA, where they could very easily go and ask the C# language service or the Visual Basic language service, hey, what symbols are available here so I can build up IntelliSense or that sort of thing. And so I'm hopeful that the work that we're doing on RASA that's related is that we will help them improve their performance in the long run. But again, I am not an expert in the XAML Editor. I just gave you some, like, I've heard these things, kind of vagary. So, okay. Actually, back there at the microphone?
Yes. So sometimes we have bugs or performance issues that only show up in production. If running Perfue on a production system, is that going to cause a big performance hit? Do you have, like, any kind of general thoughts on you know, how much it's going to slow down?
Well, I wouldn't run Perfue, but remember that ETW is built into Windows, right? And so there are tools you can use to collect ETW on a production machine and, you know, just collect traces from a customer. Even if you have a customer, there are tools you can send and say, here, run this, run the app, do your thing, and then send me the file it output. And then you can analyze it in Perfue, right? But because it's built into Windows at the core, it's not really that impactful to the system.
Okay, so
you can get systems that are where they instrument way too much, but it tends to be fairly frugal, and it's kind of the right sorts of events triggering.
So not a big performance hit to collect ETW.
Not generally. You can get into systems where there are ETW providers that are that are too chatty, and they flood it. But the systems in Windows and you know, if you instrument your own ETW events and do it wisely, then you shouldn't have a trouble.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
So in the new Visual Studio 2013, I see in other sessions. So there are some new features to see when I write my code. I can see how this method is being referenced in other functions.
Yeah. So you mean the code information indicator?
Right.
Yeah.
So those are very fast and not, according to other speakers, they are not affect the performance when people writing the code in the editor. So how those are tasks are more like I/O bound task. So when you import a very big project, how you make this task very fast and not affect the performance of the Visual Studio?
Okay, so I think I got the key pieces out there. Correct me if I'm wrong, I'm going to try and repeat that back. So the code information indicators, and specifically the references indicator.
Right.
You were wondering, it sounded like to me, you were wondering if on a large solution, how do you do that work without bringing down Visual Studio's performance, right?
In some other editor, I see some...
Okay, so I'm deeply involved in that, because that actually, this release of Visual Studio, under the hood, uses Roslyn bits to do the find all references work, and so the way we've done that is it's out of proc, okay, and so there's another process that's running that will kind of keeps in sync with the information and bits it needs in a Roslyn kind of world over here, and all Visual Studio does is pass messages over. Oh, you added a file. It's this one on disk. Oh, you opened this project, and then they ask find all references for this, and it's kind of all hot and filled out with you know all this data, and so that's how they do it. It's actually done in another process. So it could run your battery down, I suppose, by just doing a bunch of work in this other process. But that's how it keeps Visual Studio from incurring overhead. Okay. Does that make sense?
Okay. So it will involve a lot of read and write operations to read the file.
Sorry, could you speak into the mic? Sorry.
I mean, You must generate some data structure in the memory, and it will read a lot of files.
And that is all done in the other process. Partly because the Roslyn language service pieces, the pieces that integrate with Visual Studio, aren't in Visual Studio 2013. They're not there yet. They will be in a future release. And when we do that, we will be replacing the old C++, C# and Visual Basic language services that kind of are the integration pieces for the languages in Visual Studio. We'll be replacing them with new ones from Roslyn. And so what we've done is we kind of take, and so then when that happens, they'll be able to just ask Roslyn. They'll be able to ask it in prod. Tell me the references for this. And yes, we build up a lot of data there, but we're very smart about how that data is done. It's generally very lazy. It only goes through the parts it needs to go to find references. It doesn't search your whole solution. It only searches the connected projects and the project dependency graph. It only searches files that might have that identifier in it. We use intelligent algorithms to rule out files that definitely don't have. So there is some smarts built in to make final references generally very efficient in the Roslyn piece, and then to make this version of Visual Studio work so that we didn't have that in proc, it's out of proc.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
In one of the slides, you said if your collection is like less in size count, you recommend using list of key value pair versus dictionary.
Oh yeah, an array of key value pair can be faster than just having a dictionary.
Based on your experience, is there any threshold like on the number of items beyond which you recommend using dictionary versus list of T?
I would experiment and use a profiling tool. I'm reluctant to give you a specific number in here because it will probably not work, and I will be wrong, and you'll be mad at me, and then I'll get hate mail. But, you know, thinking like, I'll give you a vagary. Try up to 100, right? It's probably going to be totally reasonable performance overhead that you would not even notice. All right. Okay?
Thank you.
Is Roslyn the candidate for implementing aspect-oriented programming, or is that kind of outside the scope?
Oh, a Roslyn question. We can talk more after if you like. In V1, we are looking at some of these kinds of scenarios in aspect-oriented programming because they do get asked a lot. But in V1, I mean, Let me put it this way. We have a set of priorities, and priority number one is to ship a working compiler that still compiles your code and doesn't break. Priority number two is to produce an IDE that doesn't slow you down and make you hate me. And then other priorities fall below those. So I think consider that so that maybe in a V1 you might not see. It might be something you can do with a lot more effort, and something that we might actually attack and look at really solving better with API in a future release. So it's something that could target that, but I'm not saying that that the first release is going to target that.
Thanks.
Okay. Yeah.
In a profiler, if I find a method called large number of times, is it a good idea to switch from managed to unmanaged, optimize in unmanaged, and use it that way?
If you find a method called a large number of times, is that a good reason to switch from managed to unmanaged where calling? I would say generally no. The actual act of calling a method on the CLR is very, very efficient. It's certainly not as efficient as a direct, you could make it more efficient in native code. It would be very difficult for you to go very far with that and get to something that was truly noticeable unless it was being called. We're talking billions of times, right, to get into nanoseconds, right? It would be very difficult because in the CLR, a lot of the jitter does a lot of work to make sure that calls are just as direct as they are in native code. So, yeah. Yep, it's on.
Okay. I want to know what the experience has been like working for the new compiler, because I don't really see you guys literally going around writing link expressions, private inner classes, and these higher language constructs in order to match the output of the current C++ compiler.
I'm sorry, one more time? I apologize, I didn't quite understand.
So what is the name of the project again?
Oh, Roslyn.
Roslyn, and what it's looking to do is you want to do a compiler that's in C#, to compile C#.
Yeah.
So the bits and pieces of code that we saw using link expressions and and methods for the framework, do the developers really go around using those liberally, or you actually end up?
We actually let people use our language when they write in our language?
Yeah, I figure that a lot of people are writing their own substring functions using memcopy and stuff like that instead of using higher level stuff.
No, we do use the framework. We use it pretty liberally. We use now in the compiler, partly because it just has that pure CPU bound thing. At one point, they banned using link in the compiler, just because it was harder to reason about, and they really were going for raw performance. In the IDE, we use it a lot, partly because we're doing things asynchronously, and so things are happening in the background, and it's not a problem you notice, and the code is still, is very, very readable, very nice, and we're not as concerned. When Profiler points at something and says, no, this one needs to change, this is a problem, we'll change it. But in general, we've been very liberal with using link and lambdas in the IDE. Again, like I said at that slide, it was not a blacklist of features to go back and start writing C# 1.0 code to be performant. That's not reality. You want to write good code, readable code, code that others can come to later and see how it works, because it needs to be code that's going to live, right, for a long time. So we do use our features. We use iterators because it's convenient, much more convenient than allocating things. We use async, and we've used it to improve performance, where there's still going to be, with async, often there is more overhead, right, and there are more allocations with async, but we've found that it improves performance. So I would always recommend using, in a lot of cases, those features, because sometimes they'll optimize under the hood, like the for each case against list enumerator, right? That optimizes such that, it's very, very cheap to for each over that. And so we use them. I guess that's the answer. I will stop ranting, but that's the answer. All right, we have 1 minute left. Are there any other questions? Yeah, back there.
Any performance comments on the dynamic keyword?
Any performance in the dynamic keyword?
Yeah.
Not at the moment. There's been some rumblings about dynamic and what we should do there to improve performance. Because, dynamic effectively is running the C# semantics at runtime, so it can pick the correct overloads for functions and that sort of thing. There are no performance improvements that I'm aware of coming in the next release, but it is something we're talking about a little bit, and it's something we're on our minds.
So there's no current gotchas, like some of the other.
Well, there are gotchas. Yeah. There are certainly gotchas. I think the biggest gotcha with Dynamic. Okay, if you wanted a gotcha from Dynamic, we don't use it in the Roslyn source space except in unit tests. We find it's very convenient for certain things in unit tests. The biggest gotcha is that Dynamic tends to be somewhat viral through your source code. And so if you get something back that's dynamic and you just, I just want to call this function over here, and you forget to cast something, now that function is dynamic, right? And it's called in a dynamic fashion. And you can start getting this case where, okay, now the return type becomes dynamic. And you get these places where it starts to leak through the system, even if you just want to call this one call, make this one call in a dynamic fashion. So that's something to be aware of and be careful of. I find when I use dynamic, I'm constantly going over with quick info to see what the types, hovering over things to see what the types are to make sure that dynamic's not leaking out in a way that I didn't intend, because then you get allocations you never expected were going to happen. So that is something to think about, but all right.
I have a simple question.
Yeah.
I don't understand why the boxing is causing an allocation. It's just a the boxing is causing an allocation.
Boxing causes an allocation because normally normally value types are just, they're raw memory size, right? 4 bytes for an integer, 1 byte for a byte. When they're values and they're on the stack. But then when they get heap allocated, so that you can, if you want to say, oh, this is an int, but now I want it to be iconvertible, right? Or I want it to be, iComparable or something like that, because it does implement those interfaces. And as soon as it does that, it needs to put it on the heap so that it can call virtually through, because you're going to pass it around now. And it loses the notion that it's an int when you pass it around. So there's a very different notion of kind of stack allocated value types versus heap allocated objects in the .NET framework.
Okay, so this is only for value type, right? It's just for structure.
Yeah, only value types get boxed. And when a value type gets boxed, it's like thinking, oh, it just became an object, right? So now, and you'll see that when you pass it to functions that take an object, like format, right, where all of the parameters for passing the format specifiers all are object, right, so that you can pass anything in there, including value types. But value types have the overhead of being converted to object, which boxes them.
Okay, I took that structure and the class was inheriting from object, so
yeah,
that's okay.
All right. Okay, I think we're out of time, guys. So thank you for being, hanging out and having some questions. That was very fun. Thanks.